Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Gentle Rambler. This is episode 68, and I'm so happy that you've tuned in this week. Friday, the 16th, was actually the Rambler's 39th birthday. The previous 2 years, we had an episode on the 16th, but since I'm 1 year away from 40, I'd rather not make too much of a fuss over it. But if any of you out there feel free to send me some birthday wishes if you'd like. So anyway, we took a few weeks off, but we're back at it. And this week we have a few main topics we're going to get to. The first one is the one that garnered 80% of the vote on our recent Twitter topics poll. And that is the devastating forest fires happening in northeastern Canada, which blanketed the east coast of the United States for several days about a week and a half ago. It's something none of us have ever really experienced, especially anyway here in New York. I mean, I spoke to a few, let's say, like, old-timers, and in all their years, you know, how they they reinforced how unheard of this type of climbing catastrophe is, and how damaging these fires are for our planet. I'm going to read a piece from Scientific American, and it's going to focus on a bit of climate change and some of the potential causes of these fires. And if we're going to expect worse in a future or worse in the future. Here goes it. Canada's wildfires are a warning of the East Coast's smoky future. Wildfires are still raging in eastern Canada, even as much of the smoke has dissipated from the northeastern United States. And as long as those fires continue burning, there's a risk the smoke may, quote, may simply be directed toward other areas of the United States, according to the National Weather Service. The episode is a wake-up call for the East Coast, which has far less experience with wildfire smoke than the highly flammable West. Shrouded in haze, places like New York and D.C. experienced their worst air pollution on record last week and got a possible glimpse of their future in a changing climate. I remember the Wednesday of that week, Tuesday and Wednesday were the worst days, but Wednesday was the worst day. And I remember hearing from the old mainstream media about how at that on that day, New York's air quality was the worst in the world. And obviously a natural disaster happening 300 miles north of us. But, you know, you think usually, and I check these numbers once in a while, and it's usually, you know, the top 10 cities, most polluted cities. I believe like 7 of them are Indian cities, and the other 3 are I believe, Chinese cities. And we know how, especially with India, you know, they're still burning fossil fuels and they feel like, you know, while we were a colony, while you guys really started with the Industrial Revolution, which was the beginning of the, you know, mass pollution in the United States. So they feel like, you know what, fuck you guys. You know, you made all those millions of dollars off of burning fuels. And, we're going to jump on that and, you know, get ours, as they say. Moving on, this is a quote here. We know that the weather conditions that are triggering these events, and they are getting more frequent and more severe, said Jan Boulanger, a research scientist in forest ecology with the government agency Natural Resources in Canada. While Western Canada has seen more intense fires and wildfires in recent years, researchers are still teasing on how climate change will affect blazes in Eastern Canada. A 2018 study, which looked at fire trends across the country since the early 50s, found no clear trends in the region. But that study is already a bit out of date, said Jinlei Wang, a fire research scientist with Natural Resources Canada and one of the study's authors. It doesn't account for the last 7 years of data, meaning there could be new emerging trends that researchers haven't yet identified. So really, I don't think anybody can really, you know, certainly or you know, for sure, tell us, what's really going to happen. Like, there's no template here for this. There's no way to figure out, like, is this going to get worse? Is this an anomaly? Is it going to, like, come and go? Is it just, you know, once in a blue type of thing? And I'm going to have to lean towards no. Because of the climate's getting, global warming. Obviously, Canada, Northern Canada, Quebec province, it's always quite cold there in the winter. I heard they had a very mild winter. And just the sheer fact, you know, like I've been saying this to people, you know, I speak to, you know, the thing with COVID, the mass hysteria over COVID, wear a mask, wear gloves, you know, don't touch anybody's arms. But you couldn't see COVID. You know, you couldn't actually look at the problem of COVID. This stuff, I mean, this shit, I mean, you know, it was, you could see it. It was right in front of your face. I'm talking orange, thick black smoke, soot, you know, and so it's not like it's this invisible, you know, catastrophe that nobody knows what to do, and, you know, just stay in your house. I mean, this was really an apocalyptic visual for a lot of us here, especially in, like, New York City. After this year's severe fire season, Wong said, scientists may revisit the analysis to see what has changed. Eastern Canada is generally wetter and sees fewer blazes than its western counterpart. But this year began differently. Unusually dry conditions in May, coupled with record-breaking heat at the end of the month, created a surplus of dry fuel. A series of thunderstorms then provided the spark lightning to ignite the tinder. So there you go. There you go. You got a dry month, record-breaking heat. You know, I'm sure thunderstorms that aren't very common up in that area. Obviously, up there in Quebec, you don't. I'm sure they don't have too many like torrential thunderstorms like they have down in like South Carolina. So, like I said, there's no frame of reference like from the past. You know, I've heard you know, so many older folks at times say, "Oh, 1957 was the hottest summer on record," and you know, there was no talk of climate change then. It's like, okay, well, that was just like a random, you know, like I used the word anomaly before, but you know, then you look at say the hottest years on record, the top four hottest years on record, and they're all basically in the 2000s. This is a quote again from Mr. Boulanger. It was quite a kind of a perfect storm that arrived at the end of the month of May for Quebec. Hundreds of blazes have so far burned more than 17,000 square miles across the country, according to the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center. That's more than 10 times the average burned 10 times the average burned area for this time of the year. Around 200 of those fires are burning in Quebec and even in Ontario. Now, you know, forest fires, you know, it used to be like, you know, Smokey the Bear must be, he's running out of ideas. I mean, you know, only you can protect forest fires. And you know what? There's going to have to be some major radical changes in how we deal with the atmosphere and how we deal with fossil fuels. They've made great, amazing strides in clean energy, cheaper energy. And I wasn't a big environmentalist until fairly recently. But the more that I see, the more that I experience the fact that I have two young children. You know, I was very apathetic in my early, late 20s, that like, it was just like, shit, man. You know, I got problems with, I got financial problems. I got, you know, problems with like pharmaceutical companies or whatever the case was. And I was a little self-indulgent, and I didn't quite care about what would happen to the Earth, let's say, in 50, 60, 70 years. But then you have a child, and you're going to put somebody, another human, you know, ahead of yourself. And to think that the word kinship, you know, they grow up, they become adults, and look at the world that they might have to deal with. Do I have to regret? Am I going to have to regret bringing two children into this world for the simple fact that the whole thing's going to blow up in our face or in everybody's face eventually? And, you know, maybe not an apocalyptic event, but, you know, it's going to be, I mean, going to have mass exoduses from different locations around the world. I mean, it's crazy. It's scary. And having children really makes me really pay more attention to this. Research suggests that the fire season will worsen in the coming decades as the climate changes. 2022 study, for instance, found that the Hudson Plains region, which includes parts of Quebec and Ontario, will likely see the number and size of wildfires increased faster than most other regions. Here's that Wang guy again, noted that another 2022 study also suggested that, quote, with the changing climates, we may see greater magnitude changes in the east than in the west. Researchers can link individual extreme weather events, including wildfire, to climate change through so-called attribution studies. Until one is conducted for this year's fires, it's unclear to what extent they are influenced by global warming. So they're trying to tell us they're not too sure yet, but I mean, it seems like a lot of the signs are pointing in that direction. You know, they did mention earlier about the really hot, they had like a heat wave up there recently in May, or it was really dry in May, and these are all things that some people might think are you know, might perceive as minor, you know, it's a little bit of a hot May, but, you know, everything, you know, go back to normal. And I don't think it's going to. And I think this whole thing is happening a lot faster than any expert or scientist could ever have imagined. So I'm going to finish off this piece right here. Still, experts say such severe blazes are a harbinger of the future and one that Eastern Canada may never be prepared for. Boulanger warned, For instance, many communities in Western Canada follow the guidance from FireSmart, a national program designed to help residents prevent, mitigate, and prepare for wildfires. Such programming is implemented less frequently in the eastern provinces. But if the region burns more frequently in the future, he said, communities may want to start preparing now. So I think there's a good piece there from the Scientific American, giving us some good information, you know, very objective information, and some terrifying information. And I mentioned the thing about the kids, but I also mentioned, you know, how politicians, you know, 95% of the politicians, you know, when they run for office, especially Democrats, they want to pretend to all be like, a hippie, you know, tree hugging and everything. And they're mostly full of shit, pretty much all the time. And well, they're pretty much full of shit about everything. But anyway, so quickly, I was, thinking yesterday about former Vice President Al Gore and his film Inconvenient Truth, and how, you know, entertainment-wise, I really found it tedious, but I gotta say, man, he really provided all of this, like, you know, a lot of this information back over 20 years ago, and, you know, how the masses of society, and including myself, it kind of mocked him at the time. You know, and I think that he really gave us a really very big template of what could happen and what has happened. I mean, it was very a prophetic film looking back on it. So anyway, we're going to be moving on. But before we get to Trump, I just wanted to do a quick update on the war in the Ukraine. Talking about the much anticipated summer counteroffensive. And also the humanitarian crisis caused by the dam destruction in the city of Kharkov. We have a piece on this from Reuters. I'm going to get to it quickly because we got a couple more things we got to do here. Russia tries to signal normalcy as Ukraine forces advance. It starts off here. Russia announced plans on Thursday to stage elections in occupied parts of Ukraine in just 3 months. Moscow's latest bid to signal it is in control, even as Ukrainian counteroffensives has pushed its forces back in some areas. The Ukrainian assault is in its early stages, and military experts say the decisive battles still lie ahead. But corpses of Russian soldiers and burnt-out army vehicles lining the roadside and villages newly recaptured by Ukrainian troops attested to Kiev's biggest advances this year. Quote, our heroic people, our troops on the front line are facing very tough resistance, Zelensky told NBC News in an interview. Quote, because for Russia to lose this campaign to Ukraine, I would say actually means losing the war. And I think he's right on there. But, you know, I was reading something on another, I was doing a little research and reading a different periodical. And the West is in a funny situation here, because I think if the Ukraine really starts, you know, taking the war to the Russians and making a lot of, you know, headway of, you know, gaining back cities, gaining back ground. And we know how Putin is, or how he talks like he is, big tough guy, you know, want to scare everybody, that maybe he will eventually, you know, go to the nuclear weapon, you know, release the nuclear weapon, or even like continue to threaten about using nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, you don't want Russia to get the upper hand, because then you gave all this fucking money to the Ukraine to try to help them win the war, and then it would be a total failure. Continuing, Zelensky said the news from the front lines was, quote, generally positive, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult, according to a partial transcript of the interview. Continuing his campaign for military assistance, Zelensky urged the Swiss parliament in a video address to allow other states to re-export Swiss-made weapons to the Ukraine, saying such a move by the neutral country would be vital. Now, if they're neutral, Mr. Zelensky, why would you try to solicit weapons from them, man? I think that's a little off base. Leave the Swiss alone. You know, they didn't get involved in any wars for the last, 200 years. And now you know, everything's so damn important for you and your Ukrainian country, which, you know, it's a big war going on and they need help. But if they're going to go for Swiss now? I mean, they're neutral. Anyway, moving on. Reuters reached the villages of Neshkishen and Storohoziev over the past 2 days, providing the first independent confirmation of the Ukrainian advance several kilometers southwards along the Mokrai Yali River into territory Russia has held since the early days of the invasion last year. Several bodies of Russian troops lay in the streets of ruined and depopulated villages. Ukrainian troops in Storozhev told Reuters that they had killed around 50 Russians and captured four. The Ukrainian military, which had maintained strict silence about the campaign for more than a week, can come forward to tout the gains on Thursday, holding its first full media briefing since the counteroffensive began. Now, of course, they paint you a rosy picture. Even if the offensive was stalling, they're not going to come out here and say, "Shit, man, we're really struggling here, and we're not winning. We're staying." You're going to keep morale high. You know what I mean? Every propaganda comes into every war, no matter how much you love the Ukraine out there, no matter how much you despise the Russians. Propaganda is everywhere on every side. So somebody like Zelensky is going to come out and rightfully so, he's going to tout his military advances, whether or not they only advanced, 3 miles in 2 days. He's going to say, "Well, we advanced somewhere." Here's a quote: "We are ready to continue fighting to liberate our territory, even with our bare hands," Zelensky said. Oh, he's so tough. The army on the southern front had advanced up to 7 kilometers, 4.4 miles in the area along the Makryali, as well as up to 1.8 miles on another axis further west near the village of Malatakmachka, Ukrainian military officials said. They described advances in the east around the ruined city of Bakhmut, which Moscow seized last month as its only major combat prize during the winter and spring offensive that saw the bloodiest ground combat in Europe since World War II. Now, since we were off a few weeks, I was going to get to the ending of the Battle of Bakhmut, especially the role that Wagner played in it, because I did an episode a few months or so back about the whole prisoner, soldier thing and how wacky it was. But you know what? In the end, it seems like the mercenaries were ones that they fought into the city. They were the ones that basically they put up their little capitalist flag next to the Russian flag, and it's like, hell yeah, man, capitalism rules. We bought some mercenaries, we busted some thieves out of prison, and look at us, we're in the center of the city. And in a way, man, I think it's kind of like, it's almost perfect, in these times with the way the world works, with capitalism and how, the classism in this world is becoming we're going back to like the dark ages. Like, oh yeah, let's just bring the prisoners out. We don't really need them. And if they die, who gives a shit, right? So let's not use our real soldiers for this crazy mission, for this city that nobody even really cares too much about. Let's use them. Why are we going to let our real soldiers die? We're just going to skip ahead here a little bit because we got up against time. The big test of Ukraine's offensive still lies ahead. Russia has had months to prepare its defenses. Ukrainian troops have yet to reach the heaviest Russian defensive fortifications, which are set back from the front line. Kiev is believed to have prepared an attack force of around 12 brigades of thousands of soldiers each, mostly using newly arrived Western armored vehicles. Only a fraction of them have been engaged so far. So I guess they're going a little slow, taking it slow with, the million-dollar tanks and everything, because, you don't want to send them out there if they're not ready. They got to be properly trained before they go out there, and fight and use, technologically advanced weapons. Weapons that the United States gave to them, money the United States gave to them. They better damn use it wisely. Well, they better use it, in an ethical way. It better not be like, okay, the war goes to a stalemate, and then it's just like, oh, we got all this money left over. Let's go to the casino. We can't have that. We got to make sure, Zelensky seems all right, but let's see what happens, later on in the future when this war does finally end. Let's see what kind of guy he is. Let's see. We're going to finish this off now. Russia, for its part, has released images of Western tanks and armored vehicles. It said it has destroyed or captured. The head of the UN Atomic Agency, Rafael Grossi, visited the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant and said the situation at the site was, quote, serious, but the level of cooling water was sufficient following last week's devastating breach in the Kakhovka Dam downstream of the Dnipro River. So that's the piece on that. They didn't mention too much about the dam, but I'm glad the last paragraph there dealt in that. I wanted to more just give an update on what was really, what was happening, with the counteroffensive, and give you a little bit of an idea of how the things are, how each side, or especially the Ukrainian side, how they're going about, how they speak to the media, and give their assessment of the current situation there. Okay, so Anyway, we've been discussing this war on and off since well before it even began, and my opinions have it's swayed in both directions, and I'm fucking sick of not just reading about it or discussing it, but of course I'm really obviously the amount of money being pumped into the Ukrainian war effort. We have North American forest fires. North American forces being reduced to ashes. Our upcoming American presidential election is it's something that really needs to be addressed, and not just because of Trump's criminal case, but just for the sheer fact that these two 80-year-old men are not qualified to be president, and they never were. We're going to get to the Trump's, or a quick update, or a little piece on the Trump's classified document fiasco. And, in a weird way, kind of this whole situation with what's coming up with the election with all these, I don't know, you call them septuagenarians or octogenarians now. It kind of reminds me of, like, the demise of the USSR. Remember, I remember seeing those images of the Soviet leadership and, 5 or 6 of them in wheelchairs, And there's a lot of similarities now about, the way the USSR went down and, of how hopefully history doesn't repeat itself. But I do detest ultra-capitalism. But I'm an American citizen. And I'm trying here, for fear of my children's future. It's getting worse. It's getting much worse. And I can't see it getting any better. Especially worse. Talking about getting worse, let's get into Trump's Florida case, his indictment, and his likely, or more than likely, upcoming trial. This piece we're going to read from quickly is actually focusing on how the public, or the court of public opinion about Trump, and how Trump seems to be relishing in all this negative attention, like a comic book supervillain. So anyway, we got a piece from Political, and we're going to breeze through this one. It's titled, How Trump's Indictment Defense Might Fend Off Its Classified Document Charges. Quickly, one consequence of former President Donald Trump's indictment by the Justice Department is that many Americans will learn a thing or two about how federal prosecutors actually work. Tuesday's lesson from Miami, the first hearing in a criminal case is not that interesting. Everyone involved, the government, the defendants, their lawyers, and the court, is looking much further ahead. I mean, this thing, from what I've heard from a lot of people, it's going to drag on. I mean, he might become president and then lose, get 4 years of being a president and still be going on. And a lot of us are fearing that happening, just Trump being able to blow this whole thing off. Trump was represented by Todd Blanche and Chris Kyes, following the departure last week of two attorneys who had been handling Trump's defense while the case was still in investigation stage. Blanche is a former federal prosecutor in Manhattan who was already working on Trump's defense in the criminal prosecution brought by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office earlier this year. His task now in Florida is to prepare and conduct an effective criminal defense in the most high-profile criminal case in recent memory. It's a quick piece here, but I wanted to read one part here about how the evidence, an alternative narrative. Now, they gave you kind of like this list of six things that the lawyers are going to try to try to win the case or get the case thrown out for Trump. And I read this one about the alternative narrative. And real quick, I'm going to read this, before we sign off. Okay, an alternative narrative. Trump's lawyers are also no doubt looking for something in the way of a coherent alternative narrative to advance in court and at trial. After the search of Mar-a-Lago last year, Trump and his since-departed lawyers offered an array of factual claims and arguments in the court of public opinion, but they never came together to form a cognate and persuasive account of what transpired that might actually help Trump. Of course, Trump is under no obligation to prove his innocence in court. Like all criminal defendants, the burden is on the government to establish Trump's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's no requirement for Trump to testify or even call any witnesses. So they're making a point that, obviously he's got so many privileges being an ex-president. But, in our Constitution, it says what it just said here. No matter who you are, you have the right to all of this. No matter how much the mainstream media hates you, no matter how much, you know, your rivals on the other party or whatever hate you, you're still expected to get a fair shake. Now, I'm worried Trump's going to get a much too fair shake because it's down in Florida, and all his minions are down there. That woman that's the Florida Supreme Court judge or whatever, I can't remember her name at the moment, but she tried to get the case thrown out a couple of months ago, and then it went to what do you call that, the appeals court, and three other Trump appointees, you know, lower judges or whatever, said, no, we're not going to risk our career, we're not going to destroy our reputation for this jerk-off just because he put us here. You know, we worked our whole life to become Supreme Court or appellate judges. You know, we went to college for how many years? You know, sat on the bench, we're lawyers, lawyers, all sorts of different things. And I guess I got to give him credit. I wouldn't think somebody who achieved so much as a Supreme Court, a state Supreme Court judge, or even a state appellate judge, is going to throw it all away for Donald Trump. And hopefully they think, some of them, or I would, think in the back of my mind that Donald Trump doesn't care about anybody but himself. So why would you go out on a limb and, you know, risk your neck or risk your career, risk your reputation for someone like him just because you feel indebted to him because he put you on the bench? You know, and if somebody would go through with doing something like that, you shouldn't be a judge. You shouldn't be a judge in Schenectady, New York. You shouldn't be a judge in Tupelo, Mississippi, and you certainly shouldn't be the Florida Superior Court judge, because you are not qualified, you're not ethical enough, and Trump always thinks that, you know, he's got a lot of sycophants. We actually wrapped up that little news piece quickly, not too quickly, but I wanted to get to the point of how, you know, Trump is expected to be, experts are saying that more or less, will take this to trial. And Trump, you know, he's got the right to all those different things, no matter how much we dislike him, no matter how much of a bigot he is, no matter how much he didn't stand by the Constitution. You know, this is how the world works. This is how the justice system works. It's very unfair. It's unfair to African Americans, and it's unfair to poor people. But of course, it's going to be fair for Donald Trump. I promise you that. And this whole fucking deep state theory, I'm getting tired of hearing it. Because for a while, man, I was starting to buy into it. Because they keep trying to get something on Trump, you know, heavy enough where he can go away. You know what I mean? They're not going to whack him or whatever. So they're trying to do these things. You know, the Russia Gate, and you had that thing with the Ukraine. Then obviously Stormy Daniels came around again. You know, they brought that up. And I was thinking, man, you're making him an empathetic figure, and I think you should stop. And even when this thing came up, I was like, oh, they're bringing up the classified docs again. What about Biden? What about Pence? But then when you see the visuals are important in these type of instances. Like even with the OJ case, with the blood all over the place, the bloody gloves and everything, visualizing, you know, I'd say, in my opinion, visualization in a criminal court, I think it's a big thing, man, because, you know, you see something, you hear your lawyer up there babbling on for an hour about this and that, about evidence, all this DNA shit you don't know nothing about, but then you see pictures of Trump with these boxes, these, like, you know, cheesy cardboard boxes you'd see, like, in some warehouse in Patterson somewhere, and they're in, like, his ballroom, and they're tipped over, and they're under his pipes in like, a dingy bathroom down in Bedminster, Jersey. Or not Bedminster, there's a few there, but in Mar-a-Lago, you know, Mar-a-Lago. Sounds like kind of a dreadful place to be. But so, the visuals are going to be bad for Mr. Trump, and the actual content that is in these classified documents are, you know, they're extremely incriminating, or however you want to say it. It looks bad for him, but everybody's going to vote for him. All the Republicans are going to vote for him. What's going to happen? You saw what happened with Netanyahu. That's to a much smaller scale. They got a parliamentary democracy. It's a lot different. He's already on trial for different things, fraud, all that type of stuff. So we're going to have to see how this works out. I get tired of talking about Trump sometimes, but this was something crazy when I saw those pictures. So real quick, we got about 20 seconds left. We went through the Northeastern forest fires in Canada. We did a little update on the Russian-Ukraine war and the whole Trump Mar-a-Lago fiasco. I'm really glad you joined me. Remember, birthday wishes are welcome. This was episode 68, and I am a gentle rambler signing off.